Thanks for joining us this morning. We have in the studio, and I'm really excited about this show because I've been wanting to do a show on this subject for forever. And we're going to talk about jury duty. In the studio, we have Judge Bergen and Judge Harrington. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for letting us be
here. Thank you.
Before we get into jury duty, give us the Reader's Digest version of your background. Judge Bergen, how did you get involved with being a judge?
I attended the University of Arizona, both undergrad and law school. Practiced in defense in the civil litigation world for about 20 years. And I was actually in a trial when my opponent suggested that I apply to be on the bench. A good friend of both of ours, Bruce McDonald, who's now a federal magistrate. And that's how I started. I hadn't even thought about the job until then. And in 2011, I was fortunate enough to be appointed to the bench. And since then, I've been on the civil bench. I've been on family. I was family presiding. I then returned to the civil bench as civil presiding. And then I'm currently on the criminal bench.
And Judge Harrington, what about you?
So I also practiced in the civil law arena. And I didn't go to the U of A Law School. I went to Gonzaga University Law School in Spokane.
We'll forgive you.
And they're going to play in December.
That,
you know,
that makes
U of A in December. Yeah. I was appointed to the bench in 1999. And since then, I've been on civil bench, juvenile bench, probate bench, and criminal bench.
Juvenile bench, that has to be tough.
Juvenile bench is a very, very difficult bench. Yeah.
Well, today we're going to talk about jury duty and the different types of juries and everything that I want to know it all. Yeah, so let's start with civil juries. How do people get picked for jury duty? Everybody's always excited when they get the summons in the mail. How do you get picked? Who is your jury pool?
Well, the jury pool is made up of people in Pima County, of course, and the rule changes from time to time. Right now, it's people who have driver's licenses and people who have property. And is there a third?
I think it's voter registration.
Voter registration, yeah. And what happens is those people are generated randomly from a list of people who have basically not been selected within the last year to 2 years. And those people are summoned to court, and they come and they meet early in the morning and then are called to the various courtrooms.
Yeah. And they don't really necessarily know what's going to happen when they get to that courtroom. They don't know what the case is. There's nothing that's sent in advance that says, hey, this is the kind of case we have. We want you to be a part of the jury. It's all a surprise when they walk in.
With rare exceptions, there are very rare exceptions. Every now and then we will do some questions weeks ahead of a trial, but that's very rare, and they kind of know what the case is about. Other than that, nobody knows what case they're going to be called on until that morning. We don't know. The jury commissioner has lists as to who's going to go to what courtroom, but other than that, nobody knows.
Oh, so that's kind of planned out in advance.
Well, the jury commissioner does it. I don't know if they do it a day ahead of time or that morning. Do you know?
What I'm aware of is that at least a day ahead of time, they decide how many jurors they're going to need, and they may release some people that are in the pool. But they're the folks that are pulled or pulled for any particular courtroom are randomly selected, and I believe it's the morning of. They just put a list together, and the list kind of, you're given a numeric identifier, and then you're sent to whatever courtroom is in need of a jury at that time, because we do have trials that start at different times of the day.
Right.
Civil trials tend to start at 9 o'clock a.m. Criminal trials can begin as early as 10:30 and as late as 1:30 in the afternoon. It depends on that.
And depending on the length of the trial, that determines the number of jurors that are sent to us by the jury commissioner. So for example, a three-day trial, we get 35 jurors sent to us. If it's going to be a three-week trial, I don't remember the exact number, but
and,
it's...
And you're talking about civil, correct?
On civil, I'm sorry.
Yes, that's right.
On civil. And you'll get many more jurors. The reason being is that more people can sit for a three-day trial than they can for a three-week trial, and so we will be excusing more jurors on a three-week trial.
Okay, that makes sense.
And the reason we're kind of, and I keep clarifying the civil and criminal, is that bringing the jurors into the courtroom is pretty much the same, whether it's a criminal trial or a civil trial. On criminal trials, we also will pull more jurors for more difficult cases that have more dramatic facts, where some people may not feel the ability to sit through and listen to the evidence or hear or see the evidence that's being presented.
Have you ever had a sequestered jury?
I have not.
No, I have not. And I think the last sequestered jury that we had, well, I take it back. There was a back in the, I think, early 90s, Judge Michael Brown moved the jury up to Prescott in a murder case where they had two juries going at one time, and there was a request to sequester the jury, and he denied it. So it's been at least since then.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah.
I think it's exceptionally rare. Although we weren't involved in the Jody Arias trial up in Maricopa County, I am aware that there was a request to sequester that jury, and that was denied as well. So it's a very rare exception. I do know that in other states, it can be more common. I attended a conference recently where folks from St. Louis were telling me, we sequester all the time. And because they are more they have more issues with people doing research and paying attention to media during trial when they really shouldn't do that.
You're not supposed to do that.
No,
even I know that. I remember going into a case where there's a bunch of us, like you said, there's 35, maybe more people called in. And being out in the hallway listening to comments made by different jurors or potential jurors, and you guys are in the courtroom, so you're not hearing it, but I've heard people say, why don't they just put all our names in a hat and pick them? And, you know, you go sit over there, and you get what you get. But the last several times I've been summoned to do this, I've watched judges painstakingly interview these people and try to get the fact that you're innocent until proven guilty across. And it just seems like, why is this so difficult to understand? I mean, you know, somebody's in there because they have 25 DUIs. Hey, they're innocent until proven guilty. What's your evidence? And how do you feel about that when you have to really pound it into their heads, you know?
Well, I think it's critical. And it's not frustrating. For me, anyhow, because I don't think it's an obvious idea that of innocent proof until proven guilty. I think we can all understand that phrase, but until you sit there and really think about the fact that you have someone sitting at the defense table who's been charged with a crime, and what I often say to jurors is that, look, if we stopped right now before any evidence was presented and you start deliberating, your verdict must be guilty. Because this person hasn't been...
Not guilty.
Must be not guilty. Thank you.
I was going to say.
I'm better on the bench, okay?
Never written down.
You're going to jail.
No, it must be not guilty because there's been no evidence presented and there's been no proof. And so that starts the discussion where people start saying, well, okay, I understand that someone must have been charged, but that doesn't mean anything really. All it is a piece of paper with a charge.
And you know... Exactly. We've all been sitting around a restaurant table or a coffee table or whatever it might be, and people talk about, they'll ask me, why do you waste so much time on these people? They're already guilty. We know they're guilty because they've been arrested. Well, that's not necessarily true.
Yeah.
And so another question that's asked, in addition to the one that's asked by Judge Bergen, some judges will say to a prospective criminal jury, if you were to make your verdict based upon what you know now, how many would find the defendant guilty? And if any hands raise up, you either have to say, you know, you can't go into this thinking that they're guilty and having a mindset that they're guilty because our Constitution says the opposite.
Right.
And so you either have to get a buy-in from that or you have to release that juror.
Yeah. And on the civil side, the experience that I've had, and I suspect you have too, is that the McDonald's coffee case always comes up.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So, and as, and people start talking about, well, you know, these lawsuits are designed just to make money and there really isn't an injury. And it's a challenge to talk people through and say, you don't know anything really about this case and you have to reserve judgment until the evidence has been presented and decide only based upon what's been presented in the courtroom. So
yeah, hearsay doesn't work.
Hearsay doesn't work well, and biases that you bring into the courtroom. So right. if you feel that the McDonald's coffee case was decided wrongly, that shouldn't play into your judgment on the case that you're hearing now. And vice versa, if you think it was decided rightly, it still shouldn't play into the case that you've been called to hear now because it's only the evidence that's presented in the courtroom.
For that particular case.
Correct.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guests today are Judge Bergen and Judge Harrington, and we're talking about jury duty and the differences between civil juries, criminal juries, and grand juries. So, tell us the difference.
Well,
you start.
I'll start. Civil juries, number one, are almost always eight people. There's exceptions to everything in the law, but generally eight people. And a unanimous verdict is not required. A verdict of 6 out of 7 is required.
Eight.
6 out of 8. I'm sorry. 6 out of 8.
I owed you one.
I got to get this coffee going again. Criminal has two different types of juries, which Judge Bergen's on the criminal bench right now. I'm on the civil bench. But they have either 8 jurors or 12 jurors, depending on the crime, and they are required to be unanimous. And then grand juries are a different thing altogether, and Judge Bergen has a lot more experience on those than I do, so he can tell you a little bit about that.
Sure. And on the criminal juries, I am taking great pleasure in correcting you a little bit. It doesn't necessarily depend upon the crime. It depends on the risk of the sentence.
Okay.
If it's 30 years or above of the risk of the sentence, it's 12 jurors are called in. Otherwise, it's 8. But for grand juries, their role is different. They are deciding whether there is probable cause in order to bring charges against an individual. So grand jurors, there are a lot of differences. One is they're closed proceedings. They're not public. They're not publicly selected as others. That is one where questionnaires are sent out ahead of time just to determine those individuals who are likely to be able to serve the extended time, which is up to 4 months. But the days of service are 1 or 2 days a week, as opposed to having full, you know, every day of the week or 4 out of the 5 days of the business week. Also, grand juries, their decision isn't whether someone's guilty or innocent. Their decision is whether there's probable cause to bring the charges. So the analysis is different. The presentation is primarily from the state without necessarily additional evidence, although there's some responsibility to bring forward evidence that may be considered to be exculpatory in considering whether the charges satisfy the probable cause determination.
Well, how many people sit on a grand jury at a time?
If I recall correctly, I think there's at least 18. I think it's about 20 per
okay.
panel. They need to have at least 9 in order to hear a case and make a determination on probable cause.
So if you get a questionnaire in the mail...
I need to be a little cautious on that because I believe there's a questionnaire to determine availability for up to for that period of time.
Okay.
I may be wrong about that.
Okay, things change.
They do change.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to know You said during the break that you used to be on criminal and you used to be on civil, and now it's vice versa. How does all this happen? How do they pick?
So we have five benches. There's criminal, civil, family, juvenile, and probate. And criminal is pretty self-explanatory. Juvenile is about 30% delinquency cases, about 70% dependency cases, which means abuse and neglect cases. Family is divorce, child custody, those types of things. Probate is wills, trusts, guardianships, and conservatorships of elderly people. And then civil is basically everything else. But what you see on civil most commonly is lawsuits, whether it's a car crash, personal injury, or a dispute over property, or a breach of contract, etc. We have judges who rotate roughly every 3 years, sometimes not that often, sometimes more often. And it's where the needs are, and our presiding judge consults with us as to where we would like to sit, and then he finds out where the needs are, and he moves us roughly every 3 years or so to those benches.
So you can give them a wish list, and maybe you get your wish?
Exactly.
Maybe being the operative word. What really drives, I believe, what really drives the assignment to a bench is the needs of our community and the needs of the court. So some judges are better suited and have strengths in different benches, but there's also a value in having judges experience benches outside their comfort zone. There is an ongoing debate about whether we should have judges assigned permanently to one bench. You know, we have someone know that bench very well, as opposed to get a broader experience. And I understand that. But I will tell you, I believe I'm a better judge from having spent 3 years on family and having had little or no experience in family, because it gave me a view of not only areas of the law I had not considered before and hadn't considered how it might impact a civil case, for example. But it also taught me skills on controlling the courtroom that you don't get on other benches. So I think there's great value in moving judges from bench to bench.
And also, somebody who's not worked on that bench can bring new ideas to that area of the law.
Look at it from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's wise. Do you have to bring your own gavel?
I have like four gavels.
Yes. You use them all at once.
There you go. One was there when I got there. Maybe all of them, but one. Whenever somebody is sworn in, the Pima County Bar Association gives you a gavel.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
So
we are. That's nice.
I'm aware of. I have heard that. Currently, there's one judge who's what we call gaveled in, where they bang the gavel before you come on the bench. But I think other than that, the gavels pretty much sit in our offices and gather dust.
Oh, well, okay. What about traffic court? Is that part of this?
So, no, we don't do traffic court in Superior Court. Traffic court is handled either in the city court.
Where's that?
Pardon me?
Where's the city court?
City court is on Alameda downtown. It's a building that's in pretty rough shape. I'm told, I can't vouch for this, but I'm told it was once a parking garage and they converted it into an office building.
Oh.
And then Justice Court. And Justice Court is in the new county building on Stone right by the railroad underpass.
Okay, well, and why don't we take a quick, brief second to talk about what the differences between the courts are.
Okay.
Justice Court focuses on county crimes and for misdemeanors as well as civil fines. And in civil litigation, I think most people recognize that the jurisdiction for the Justice Court is $10,000 or below. Other than that, it's in the Superior Court. And City Court is similar, but it's with the city as opposed to the county. And okay. So they handle similar matters in that regard.
Okay, we have a caller. Ingrid, what's on your mind?
Hello. Judge Bergen, you may recognize the name Ingrid because you once sent me a letter in June of 2017. I'm looking at it right now. Thank you very much for that letter. You were talking earlier about judges being put in this position and that position based on what they want and where the need is. But something else was said, too. Sometimes it's determined that a judge isn't really suited for a certain position. On what basis is that decision made, and who makes it?
Well, first of all, Ingrid, I do apologize. I suspect the letter you may have is one thanking you for jury service.
Not jury service. It was has to do with a case which has turned into a few cases.
Okay, we're not going to talk particular cases, Ingrid.
And I'm sorry. And my point was, Ingrid, I apologize that I don't recall specifically how we've interacted. But in any case, to answer your question, I will tell you, I am unaware of any judges that have been found unsuitable for a bench. There are some that have strengths that, for example, I come from a civil background, and initially I was more comfortable on the civil bench. Determination as to where a judge is better suited is just based upon where the availability needs to be. So what seats do we need to fill and who's available to do it? But all our judges are well-suited to serve on any bench.
Thank you for your question, Ingrid. We have another caller, Gloria. What's on your mind?
Well, two real quick questions. One is, do people have to have a certain education level in order to understand the complexities of a case? That sometimes the matter being discussed seems rather complex. And the other is, how about, do you need to really be able to speak English well?
Good questions.
So English is an easy answer. And the answer to that question is you do have to be able to speak English and understand English sufficiently to understand what's going on in the trial. With respect to the educational level, the answer to that is there is no required educational level. And we have people who serve on juries from the lowest amount of education. We have a fairly large population in Tucson of people who have not graduated from high school, and we get a lot of jurors. We also have people who have extreme amounts of education, PhDs, college professors, doctors, lawyers, etc. Let me digress for just a moment, because this is, I think, a really important area that is talked about a lot. And we hear I get questions a lot about, I don't want my fate being determined by a bunch of uneducated people who don't even read the news. I hear that.
Wow.
I hear that a lot. And here are my thoughts on that. One does not have to be educated to be able to listen to the evidence and make decisions. Gloria is correct in that some of these issues are complex, and hopefully good lawyers will try to explain those to the jury. But I think we've got this idea that unless you have a high level of education, you can't understand these and make decisions. That's not true. Juries make decisions every day, and the collective wisdom of the jury is absolutely amazing how often they get it right and how rarely they get it wrong. And it's not based on the educational level necessarily. A lot of common sense. And common sense. And I think that's a good way to put it, common sense.
And we strive to ensure that the decisions that are to be made by the jury are explained at where you don't have to have a doctoral degree. I think that, the School of Hard Knocks is worth a ton when your community is deciding the issues that you've presented before them. And so I think there's great value in that.
Yeah, I've heard, being picked as a part of the jury pool, I've heard comments like, her peers are already in jail, or my peers don't behave that way, and I'll just tell them I believe in the death penalty, so I get dismissed. And the top one was, you know, just ask everybody who wants to be here and the rest of us can leave. It's like, wow. You have no idea how privileged we are to have the system in America.
Well, can you share your story with us that you told me earlier? Do you mind doing that?
No, I don't mind doing that. And the Reader's Digest version is I had a really good friend when I lived in Chicago. We both worked for the Chicago Board of Trade. And I found out her story. She had an accent I didn't really recognize. But I found out her story was she had escaped from Bulgaria through Italy, through Canada, ended up in Chicago somehow. And she was always really, she's very close to her family, her little brother and her parents. And I could always tell when she had the opportunity to speak with them, which wasn't an easy thing to do back then. And one day she actually appeared on my doorstep, hysterical crying. I couldn't console her. All I could do was hold her and wait. And I eventually found out that the government found out that she had escaped and took her little brother and her mother and father into the town square and executed them as an example of what not to do. So every time I get a jury summons, I think of Rosa, I think of her family, and I think, my God, how lucky are we?
And you know, one of the ideas that the founding fathers of this country had was to select jurors who are a check on government activity. And that's a very important part.
Yeah, checks and balances.
And when I'm in jury selection, I routinely, early on in the case, I say this, time for a civics lesson. And the first three phrases, you're nodding your head, you remember me doing this.
I do that.
The first three phrases of the preamble to our Constitution are, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union. And the third is, and to establish justice.
Right.
And that's what our juries do. And it's an incredibly important and foundational part of our government to have people so willing to come in and make these hard decisions.
It's so important. And, you know, for the last 25 to 30 years, the jury system has really been under attack tremendously. And we were talking about the McDonald's case earlier.
He's got Duncan here.
Yeah.
My coffee, yeah.
But people will say to me, I think jurors are terrible. Juries are terrible. And why is that? Well, look at the McDonald's case. And my response to that is, I don't remember what year the McDonald's case was, but it was 25 to 30 years ago. Tell me just one more case.
Yeah.
Tens of thousands of cases have been tried since that time across the country, maybe hundreds of thousands. Just tell me one more.
Well, and I answered also along with that. The McDonald's hot coffee case was more than about the hot coffee case. I'm not going to go into all the details of it. But I always share with people, you weren't on that jury. You did not hear all the evidence. You do not understand everything they had to consider. And so we really aren't necessarily the ones to say that it was a wrong verdict, because we didn't have that responsibility and we didn't have the advantage of all the evidence.
We try hundreds of cases in our Superior Court every year, hundreds. And every time I sit on a jury panel, I understand exactly how they got to their decision. I don't always agree with it. I might have done something differently, but I've yet to see an irrational decision.
Okay.
I agree.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few.
Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for staying with us. Our guests today are Judge Bergen and Judge Harrington. And I'm kind of curious, when you get, it's like a cattle drive, when all these people are ushered into the courtroom and they're standing room only, the judge will start asking questions. Give us an example of some of these questions and why do you ask them?
All right. Well, and the way I start with is the first litany of questions, which actually are the most challenging, are designed to uncover if people can serve for the amount of time that is that they need to for the trial. So I won't go through those. Those aren't the exciting ones. The other ones are really focused on whether someone carries a bias or a prejudice or is unable to consider the evidence in a fair manner and unbiased manner, based upon the facts that are presented in the case. So Oftentimes I'll ask questions, and some of them are very difficult, about have you been the victim of a crime, for example? And let's talk about that. And if you've been a victim of a crime, is that going to affect the way you see the people that are sitting in a criminal trial, sitting at these tables? Are you going to treat them fairly? Are you going to have them start at the same starting line? And I am always impressed with how honest, how direct, and the courage people show to be so honest about what their true feelings are moving forward. And I need to share that also, everyone should be aware that we recognize these can be sensitive questions that we ask, always designed to make sure we have a fair jury. But people can come to the bench and have a private conversation, and we can ensure that not the entire jury panel is listening in on the conversation. So we do protect privacies in that regard.
Now, you go up to the bench, and they have this, what is it called?
The white noise.
The white noise. Yeah. And, you know, you have this conversation, it's just like, it does, you couldn't hear.
Yeah, and that's what we really, because we recognize that not everyone wants to talk about some of their
personal stuff.
Personal things on the open. True.
How about bumper stickers and TV shows?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you watch, what is the show? I've never seen
NCIS
it.
NCIS is a
I've
big
never
one
seen asked. One.
And so here's the reason those questions are asked. Let's say, for example, one person has an Obama sticker and another person has a Trump sticker. That doesn't necessarily tell you how they're going to decide a case, but it gives you some insight into their frame of reference. It's less important for the judge. It's more important for the attorneys when they're making their selections. But as Judge Bergen says, all of our questions are designed to get to a fair and impartial jury who can decide that this case. That's what they're all designed for.
And I'll tell you, one of the more challenging aspects we've seen more recently isn't necessarily the bias and prejudice. It's the willingness to decide the case based only on the evidence that's presented. And the real challenge is because of, you know, our cell phones are search engines, and we are on them all day long. And anytime we have a question, we get them answered by our cell phones. And you're not allowed to do that as a jury. In Pima County, I'm unaware of anyone really doing or taking phones. But again, from seminars that I've been to, other jurisdictions, jurors turn in their cell phones before they begin their jury service because of those issues.
Wow.
And, yeah. And it's just become a more challenging aspect because it is so critical that the decisions be based upon the evidence that's been admitted at court and nothing else.
And only the evidence. And, you know, when I was called to your courtroom, the defense attorney was really concerned about me. And I kept saying, you know, you have to follow the evidence. You have to go where the evidence takes you. That's what decides a case, not my personal opinion. And, you know, it's just kind of sad that they have to go through these hoops.
I would encourage you not to take that personally.
I've got a complex. I'm going to therapy.
There's a lot of strategy from the attorney's perspective and providing your zealous advocacy. There are a lot of different strategies that come into choosing the jurors that you want and whether you want strong personalities versus less strong personalities, things of that nature.
Can I tell you real briefly how a jury is selected?
Yes,
outside
please.
The present. Okay, so what we do, this is a simple example for which there are some variations, but not many. So in a civil case, we'll have a jury of eight, as I said earlier. And what we'll do is we'll call 16 people into the box, into the jury box. When we get to the point where we have 16 people that we believe can be fair and impartial in deciding this case.
And this is after all the questions and interviews and everything.
After all the questions and interviews and everything by the judge and the attorneys.
Okay.
So then what happens is the plaintiff passes the panel, meaning we think it's a fair panel, and the defendant passes the panel. Then in civil, each side gets four strikes. So they haven't had any, really hardly any participation in the 35 that have come to my courtroom. They have had zero, and they've only had some participation in getting to this 16. But then each one, based upon what your bumper sticker says, what your TV shows are, those kinds of things go, I think these four would be bad for my client. So they take turns. Plaintiff strikes one, defendant strikes one. Plaintiff strikes one, defendant. And that way they each strike four and we end up with eight. That's how it's selected.
And it's very similar in criminal with just the numbers being different.
Wow. Yeah. That's kind of reasonable.
we strive for that.
Okay. I expected it to be a lot more complex. Why do lawyers hire these focus groups and do these fake juries or mock juries, if you will? Why do they do that? What kind of incentive do they have for this?
I can tell you my experiences. The experiences I had potentially as a lawyer.
Okay.
This was more than 20 years ago. The cases that I had went to mock juries were cases that had a potential of immense verdicts, $5, $10 million, but it also had a potential of zero. And there was so much at stake here that we wanted to get an idea from common people. So we hired a jury consultant who found people actually in our community. I think they brought in about 50 different people, and we broke them into groups. We presented the case to them on both sides and then asked them to tell us what their verdict would be, to see if we could come up with some idea what this community thinks. Do they think it's more like a $10 million case, or do they think it's more like a zero case?
So is it a monetary valuation that they're looking for, or is it a guilty, not guilty?
In my case, it was guilty, not guilty, which in civil we would call it liable, not liable,
okay.
Negligent, not negligent, and how much money would you award if you found them that they were negligent.
And I had a similar experience, always in civil, too. I don't have any background in relation to whether that takes place in a criminal arena. But we also got value from what was persuasive in our arguments, what was not persuasive in our arguments, what was the evidence that pushed you the way you were choosing the case versus what you found to be of little value. And that helped focus where the case presentation should be. And again, that was as a practicing lawyer. We're now recovering attorneys. So,
Okay, do you have to have a law degree to be a judge?
To be a Superior Court judge and a City Court judge, yes. To be a Justice of the Peace, you do not.
What is a Justice of the Peace do? They marry people.
They actually sit in Justice Court, and that is what we talked about before, where they handle the county cases, and they can handle criminal cases that are misdemeanors, with no more than a risk of 6 months in jail, and lower value civil cases.
So how do you apply for that job?
They're elected.
They're elected. You have to run for office.
Yes.
Correct.
I don't know anybody in their right mind who wants to run for office now. I mean, it can be really ugly.
Luckily, we don't have to do that as Superior Court judges. We have a great system here in Arizona.
Yeah, at least in our county, or in Maricopa and Pinal.
So this could be different from county to county.
Yes. Yeah, so we have what's called the Merit Selection Committee. And any county that's 250,000 people or over goes to the merit selection system.
And I just need to interrupt for just one moment on that. And that is because Coconino voted to be merit selected recently. And so it's not based on population, but they're the only ones that have done that. Yes. It's brand new.
And the rest are contested elections. And the thought behind that is in a small town like Safford, for example, everybody knows everybody.
And everybody's business.
True.
And so you pretty much know the person that you're voting for in a contested election for judge. In addition, they don't have to raise much money. Whereas in a large area, a large place like Tucson or Phoenix, I'll bet you none of your listeners know us, or it's very few. You know, we're a million people. Running on a contested election requires us to let everybody know who we are. And I know many years ago I spoke with the Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court, and at that time he told me they had to raise $5 million a year to run.
Oh my God.
We don't want our judges raising money.
No.
We want our judges to go in, do their job in a fair and balanced way, and we have that system in Arizona. It's a great system.
That's awesome.
And it was originally designed by Sandra Day O'Connor, who was one of the primary architects of it.
Very cool. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guests today are Judge Bergen and Judge Harrington. If you have a question, the number is 790-2040. And we actually only have like 10 minutes left of this show. It's gone by quickly. We were talking about a small town and, you know, picking a jury in a small town. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows everybody's business. How do you pick a jury in a small town like that?
I've actually picked a jury, and maybe you have too. I picked one in Safford when I was practicing, and I've picked one in Nogales when I was in practice.
Another small town.
Yeah. Yes. And sometimes people know the parties, sometimes they don't. But knowing a party is not necessarily an exclusion from the jury. Most attorneys in a big city get really worried about that. In the smaller communities, they're used to it. And if you know the person, it's common. And as long as you can be fair and
follow the evidence.
Follow the evidence, that kind of stuff, yeah.
One of the questions we routinely ask when selecting a jury is, do any of the jurors know each other? And that is one of my favorite questions, because one time I had one hand go up, and then I was like, okay, that has to, who do you know that doesn't know you, kind of thing. But it does, the focus in that regard is that if folks are on the jury and they know each other, whether they're going to defer to the, if one will defer to the other's judgment, because everyone's entitled to the independent judgment of each juror.
Right.
So that's another area to explore to ensure that you have a fair, impartial, independent juror.
So when you sit down and they start asking all these questions, there's a reason behind it. You asked about any lawyers?
Yes.
You asked about paralegals?
Yep.
Law enforcement? Former law enforcement, married to law enforcement.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just oh my God.
And, you know, so a lot of times the law enforcement questions are focused on the fact that we're going to have law enforcement witnesses coming in, and whether someone's likely to prejudge that witness, either to be honest or dishonest, before they even get on the stand. And every witness is to be judged by the same standard. The other aspect, when we talk about legal background, if are you a lawyer? Do you know someone who's a lawyer? The jury is obligated to follow the laws instructed by the judge, whether they agree with that law or not.
As it pertains to that particular case.
Correct. And so the exploration there is, if you don't agree with the law, are you still willing to apply it if it's instructed that way? And some people have very strong feelings about certain topics and are unwilling to follow the law. And so that may be a reason to have them excused. Most, I'd say well over 90% or so, yes, we'll absolutely follow the laws instructed.
You have any good jury stories?
Oh, good.
none we
You're
can tell.
Book?
Yeah, yeah, no. I do know of, I know of one that is not mine. It was actually Judge Marner's, where he was asking jurors, you know, whether they could serve, and one of the jurors said, "Well, I have an obligation coming up in the next week," and he said, "What is that?" And she said, "I'm one of the primary scientists involved with the OSIRIS-REx project, which was landing some spaceship on an asteroid." And he said, "What's your role?" "Well, my role is to ensure that it lands." And he said, "If we often ask, is there anyone else who can take your place and can you serve on the jury?" And he said, "What's the risk if you don't show up?" She said, "We might miss." And in that case, she was excused. But it's those are the kind of, but it takes that level of obligation in order to be excused from a jury. I'm kidding about that. It doesn't have to go quite that far. But that one was an easy call.
There are people that you dismiss for various reasons, yes. Health, childcare, I mean, you know, just because you get summons doesn't mean, you know, if you don't serve, you're not going to jail. No. I actually have to tell you, this 20 years ago, my dad passed away. I was in Chicago taking care of his estate. My dear friend was taking care of my business back here. And when she picked me up from the airport, I asked, how's everything going? She said, great, but I think you might have a warrant for your arrest because you got a summons for jury while you were gone, and I didn't tell you about it because I didn't want you to worry. So I'm just like, great, I ain't going to jail. What happens when somebody doesn't show up?
We issue a warrant for their arrest.
You issue a warrant for their arrest, and you go get them.
you can't, you know, some. We're not looking to do that. That is not, but we do have to enforce the laws and the obligations that come with it. Some judges have been creative that once a juror is selected and they failed to show up, I know of one that had his staff go out and pick them up and bring them in.
Oh, wow.
and that avoided the whole warrant issue and all that nature. We do include on our jury panels alternates, though, so that if we do end up in a situation where a juror becomes ill or unable to serve, that we can still continue.
Well, what happens if somebody shows up and they're there and after lunch they don't come back?
It happens.
It does happen.
Yeah. What do you do?
Not often.
If we don't have an alternate, we can be in trouble and it may require a mistrial.
Oh, wow. That's a serious thing.
That's very serious. And under some circumstances, jurors can, and this has happened, jurors have had to pay for the cost of a mistrial that have caused it like that.
Like how much?
Thousands of dollars.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I'm aware, not in this county, but in another county, a juror was taken into custody through and was required to stay in jail until the trial was completed.
But I have to tell you, jurors, for the most part, they're really serious about this job. They come, they hate the idea of being called, a lot of them. They're dreading the service. They then go through the process. They get selected. They serve. They are so attentive. They're so serious. They serve every day. They get paid almost nothing, 12 bucks a day.
You get paid?
12 bucks a day.
I didn't get paid.
Round trip mileage.
And round trip mileage, yeah. You should get paid.
Talk to you about this.
I have time.
And then when they're done with their jury service, almost always they are very proud of what they did as becoming making a governmental decision that's important to our community.
Absolutely. You have to be very civic-minded. And like I said, it's better than what they do in Bulgaria, right?
It absolutely is.
Next week, we're going to be talking about child abuse. So I'm hoping everybody will join us and we'll have a Tucson Police Department on and we'll talk about the various types of child abuse and what you shouldn't be doing. Until then, I want everybody to shop local, stay safe, and we'll see you next week.